I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC, and this is the news.
Race to the finish. Campaigns barnstorming the country. With just 11 days until the election, the final push to get more voters out to the polls.
That's a difficult and challenging situation to be in.
500,000 COVID deaths. A new model forecasts a deadly winter ahead as the pandemic shifts in a dangerous direction for America. More mass evacuations in Colorado. Tonight, a new threat. The raging, fast-moving wildfires could merge into a massive megafire. And historic early voting. More than 52 million ballots cast. We go inside the numbers.
Live from CNBC Global Headquarters, the facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith.
And good evening. 11 days until the election now. The last debate is in the books, and the final campaign blitz is on. Both candidates making their closing arguments as COVID cases and deaths rise dramatically across the country. President Trump is in must-win Florida, while Joe Biden is going hard after his handling of the pandemic.
We're more than 8 months into this crisis, and the president still doesn't have a plan. He's given up. He's quit on you. He's quit on your family. He's quit on America. He just wants us to grow numb and resign to the horrors of this death toll and the pain it's causing so many Americans.
President Trump holding a packed rally at the Villages near Orlando in Central Florida, one of the nation's largest retirement communities. Senior voters helped him flip the Sunshine State back in 16. But polls show their support for the president has been sliding.
This election is a choice between a Trump recovery, and I'll call it because that's what's happening. It's a Trump super recovery and a Biden depression, because you will have a depression.
Nearly 53 million Americans have already voted. We begin tonight with Eamon Javers following the Trump campaign. Eamon?
Yeah, Shep, that's right. You know, the Villages have really become the epicenter of the political battle for Florida. And this afternoon, we saw the president making a direct appeal to the voters there in a retirement community, which has its own unique mode of transportation.
And I see you driving around in those beautiful golf carts, the most beautiful carts. I want to get one. We're putting the Villages first. And if I don't sound like a typical Washington politician, it's because I'm not a politician.
Now take a live look at Pensacola, Florida. That's where we're going to see the president in about an hour's time. The panhandle of Northwest Florida, such a vote-rich target for Republican candidates. The president's team is hoping to really capitalize on what they saw as a much better debate performance last night with a sprint through five battleground states over the course of the weekend. Tomorrow, he's going to begin the day in Florida again, where he's expected to vote early in West Palm Beach. Then it's off to Lumberton, North Carolina, where he trails Joe Biden by 1.5%, according to the Clear Politics average. He'll also hit Circleville, Ohio. It's a state where that same average has him just ahead of Biden by 0.6%, a real squeaker there. He'll wrap up the day in Waukesha, Wisconsin, where he's down by 4.6%. And then on Sunday, Shep, he's going to be in Manchester, New Hampshire, where he trails Biden by 11%. Now, the president has been beaten badly in the money race so far, but they did say that he had a monster night online, raising about $26 million for Team Trump yesterday on the heels of that better debate performance for the president. And today we saw the president taking advantage of the incumbency advantage, holding an event in the Oval Office in order to show that Sudan has normalized relations with Israel. That's something that only an incumbent president can do, showing he's doing the job. Shep, back on to you.
Eamon Javers on the Trump campaign. Now Mike Memoli following the Biden campaign live in Wilmington, Delaware. Mike?
Shep, a very different scene here in Delaware. No rally, no crowd, but Joe Biden picking up where he left off in last night's debate, hammering President Trump for his handling of the COVID crisis. Biden vowing if elected president, he would immediately confer with the nation's governors, both in red states and blue states, to develop a robust pandemic response plan. Biden saying that only with a clear national strategy can the nation safely reopen its economy, saying he would not shut down the economy until we shut down the virus. Shep, now with just 10 days of campaigning left, the Biden campaign heading to a key coal-producing region of Pennsylvania tomorrow. Biden near his hometown of Scranton as the Trump campaign tries to seize on his energy plan, one to transition away from fossil fuels to only clean energy. His running mate Kamala Harris, who spent the day today in Georgia, heading to Ohio tomorrow. And we'll see President Barack Obama back on the campaign trail heading to Florida tomorrow, Shep.
Mike Memoli, thanks. The votes are coming in early and often with no signs of slowing. Get this. So far, 53 million of us have cast ballot. Steve Kornacki is here digging through the numbers as always. Steve, a lot of enthusiasm. What do we read into this?
Yeah, we read, first of all, we could have historic turnout. Think about this. In 2016, about 130 million voted. At this pace, we could be looking at 150, 160 million, numbers we haven't seen before. The other thing to keep in mind here, we're seeing early voting numbers. We're seeing more energy in them on the Democratic side than the Republican side. But let's keep in mind, that's not a surprise. I want to show you our NBC Wall Street Journal poll from last week. And we asked folks, are you planning to vote early? Or are you planning to vote on election day? Look at this difference between these two groups. The folks who say they're planning to vote early, Biden was ahead by nearly 40 points among those voters. The folks who say they're going to wait till election day, go out, cast their ballots then, almost a mirror image. There's Trump more than doubling up Biden with that category. So there's the potential there for Biden to build what seems like a very big lead now. The question then would be, could Trump undo that on election day? And by the way, that is what happened on a little bit of a smaller scale in 2016. Here was Florida in 2016. They had a lot of early voting in Florida in 2016. Hillary Clinton did very well in the early vote in Florida. There was a lot of talk she banked enough vote to win the state. But then on election day, this is what happened. Trump won by 12 points among the election day voters. You put all those ballots together, Trump got the state by a point. The lesson from 2016 is you never really know how much enthusiasm there is for both parties until you get to election day.
Steve, 11 days out, and with history as our guide, crazy stuff happens about this time in the race.
This is the time, Shep. Just think back to 4 years ago. It was 11 days before the election that James Comey, the FBI director, came out with that letter saying the Clinton email investigation was back on. Did that change the race late? That day when that happened, Clinton led the national polls by about 5.5 points on average. She ended up winning the popular vote by 2, but that drop, did that cost her the Electoral College? How about 2012? It was 10 days before the election that Hurricane Sandy hit, and Barack Obama got to showcase leadership during that. Mitt Romney was ahead in the national polls the day that happened. On election day, Barack Obama won the popular vote by 4 points. And here's one from the Wayback Machine 20 years ago, 5 days before the 2000 election, the revelation of George W. Bush's 1976 DUI arrest hit. Bush was leading in the polls by 4 points when that happened. Remember, Bush got elected president in 2000, but Gore, Al Gore, ended up winning the popular vote. Was this late surprise the reason for that?
Steve Kornacki, thanks.
You got it.
COVID watch, we're now in uncharted territory. Not even in the dark days of spring and summer did this happen. Just minutes ago, the Washington Post reported that the United States recorded more than 80,000 new cases today, the most in a single day ever. Here are the latest official numbers from Johns Hopkins. The U.S. averaging nearly 20,000 more cases a day compared to the beginning of the month. This week, 14 states hit all-time highs for hospitalizations. That's new data from the COVID Tracking Project. Those states peaking, shown here in red, and as cases surge, the virus is pushing some hospitals to the brink. This one in Idaho, 99% full, according to local reporting. Health officials there want to transfer patients hundreds of miles away to hospitals in Seattle and Portland, Oregon. New today, Dr. Fauci talked to NBC's Meet the Press for an interview set to air on Sunday. Even with COVID soaring to heights never seen, he says the coronavirus task force does not meet so often anymore, and that President Trump has not attended a meeting in months. This as researchers at the University of Washington are releasing a grim new projection. Their model estimates the United States could see nearly 500,000 deaths by February. That is if states ease more restrictions. That's the red line you see there shooting north. It's the worst case scenario, 500,000 Americans dead. But if 95% of us will wear our masks all the time, the model shows deaths could be much less. You see that clearly from the yellow line down there at the bottom. Right now, the researchers predict we're on track to hit more than 385,000 deaths by February. That's the orange line there in the middle. For context, let's bring in Dr. Ali Maqdad. He's one of the researchers behind the model, a professor of health metric sciences at the University of Washington. Doctor, thank you.
My pleasure.
That line, it's horrifying. How do you come up with those numbers, and how realistic do you believe that is?
We're looking at the data right now, and we're looking at the relationship between these variables, such as mask and mobility and, of course, testing. And we know from what we have seen in the Southern Hemisphere that the cases increased in winter, even with all the measures they put in place. So COVID-19 is seasonal, is following pneumonia seasonality. And unfortunately, in December and January, we'll see a rise in cases and in deaths.
The first time this hit us, we didn't really know it was here, I guess, and it exploded and we went to a height and we shut down. So it flattened for a while and then we went to another height and we shut down largely. This time, no signs of shutdown coming. I wonder if that gives you great pause.
It does. And unfortunately, you know, we don't want to put on the table a complete shutdown. We want to give a chance for public health and for people to help each other by wearing a mask in order not to overwhelm our hospitals and our ICUs.
If you were talking to people about their upcoming plans and the way they're conducting their lives now, kids need to be in school, and in some areas that's been deemed safe, and that makes sense. But this idea of eating inside at restaurants and going to weddings and that sort of thing, how do you explain to people this, the seriousness of all of this?
You know, it's a deadly virus. All of us are susceptible. And we're moving into winter where all our activities will move into indoor. So we need to be very careful as we move forward. And we need to change our behaviors and give science and scientists a chance to find a vaccine and a drug for this COVID-19, for the virus. So meanwhile, what we can do is wear your mask, watch your distance, wash your hands, basic public health and basic prevention in order to get out of it with less damage as possible.
Dr. Ali Maqdad, thank you so much. Theaters in New York outside the five boroughs of the big city can open again today. There'll be coronavirus safety restrictions, of course, but it's a start after the state shut everything down back in March. It's been a hard year for the industry. Just look at AMC. It's the largest theater chain in all the world, but sales in the spring dropped 99% from last year. CNBC's Contessa Brewer is live upstate New York. Contessa, if this is happening to AMC, how in the world are the small indie theaters surviving?
Oh, it's such a good question, Shep. At the Orpheum Theater, the lights are on, but nobody's home. They are allowed to open, but it's not open tonight because the health rules are so restrictive. This tiny independent theater just can't make the numbers work. But others are finding a way.
It's been a little hectic, but just to be able to open the doors again, make popcorn, it's a really, really good day.
Across New York State, movie theaters are welcoming back film lovers. The rules? 25% max capacity, no more than 50 people per screen, assigned seating, social distancing, advanced air filtration, and more staff to monitor behavior.
A little bit of trial and error, but I think we've got it down to a science now.
With coronavirus infections rising across the country and a shortage of new Hollywood blockbusters on offer.
That's the whole point of Thanksgiving, Molly.
Theaters nationwide are struggling. They're trying to innovate, launching drive-ins or private screening parties where you rent the whole theater. AMC, though, is warning a bankruptcy is looming unless it gets more cash and soon. Regal Cinemas closed down its 536 theaters around the country earlier this month, though it plans to reopen its New York facilities. And the small independent theaters, 70% say they'll fold without financial assistance from the government.
If you are open, you know, you're probably losing money, and if you're closed, you're definitely losing money. And so it's a decision, how much money are you going to lose?
Well, in a dozen counties, they can't open at all because they have coronavirus hotspots. Here at the Orpheum, they tell me they barely turn a profit in good times with only two or three people manning the theater. And they can't afford more staff or a fancy upgrade to the air filtration. They can't afford computerized reservation systems to assign the seating or new cashless payments. So for now,
the theater stays closed, Shep. Mm.
Contessa Brewer, thanks. You can fly, but you cannot hide, murder hornets. For the first time, scientists have hunted down a giant murder hornet nest in Washington State. See here? This is how they did it. Attached radio trackers to some of the invasive insects. Researchers then followed one of them back to its lair, hidden inside a tree. And sure enough, they saw murder hornets buzzing in and out around their queen. Agriculture agents plan to destroy the nest tomorrow before the murder hornets have a chance to spread to other parts of the state, especially after hibernation in the spring. The way they do that is by plugging up the exits with this foam and then vacuuming it all out. The Asian murder hornets are a huge nuisance, but more. Not only do they have incredibly painful stingers, but they can also wipe out the hives of honeybees. From murder hornets to beetles you cannot kill. Not kidding. We'll show you that just a little later. But first, something else hard to believe. The three counties in all of America that have never had a case of COVID-19.
So far, we haven't had any cases here.
We're on the ground in a county untouched by COVID-19.
Who's here to give it to us? I mean, really?
We have to move toward a net zero emissions.
The industries, jobs, and battleground states most impacted by Joe Biden's energy comments at the debate. Plus candy cannons, drones, and robots.
This is Artie.
The creative ways Americans are saving Halloween from COVID-19.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith. Back in 60 seconds.
Several major wildfires raging across Colorado right now. They're scorching land near Rocky Mountain National Park. The Cameron Peak and East Troublesome fires, now the two largest wildfires in Colorado history, and they're burning less than 10 miles apart. The U.S. Forest Service reports the two fires have ripped through more than 375,000 acres, roughly the size of this, half the size of the state of Rhode Island. The fires damaging homes and destroying property, this from Grand Lake, about two-hour drive from northwest of Denver. A local sheriff says some people are missing. No word on how many. Hundreds of people forced to evacuate this town as fires bear down on communities all about. You can see the smoke staining the skies a hazy orange. KUSA's Steve Stager is live in Granby, Colorado, near where the East Troublesome fire is burning out of control. Steve?
Yeah, Shep, we're here in Granby, which is just west of Rocky Mountain National Park, a town that has been under a pre-evacuation order for the last 2 days, just telling folks to be ready to get out, and a town that has had a thick blanket of smoke over it all day today. This fire that is impacting the town, the East Troublesome Fire, was originally about 25,000 acres, or 25,000 acres on Wednesday. It then exploded overnight Wednesday into Thursday. It grew by about 156 square miles, the size of the city of Denver overnight. Now, it's unclear. We know there is damage, but we don't know how much because they are having trouble getting into towns that have been impacted by this. The town of Grand Lake, which is just west of Rocky Mountain National Park, has been evacuated for a while now. They are trying to get in to see how much damage there is. They're not sure. The problem with the evacuations, the sheriff telling us today, they've had an issue because some people are not heeding those evacuations. He told us about that today.
If you're going to stay up in that area, please stay inside your house. People that are roaming around on the interior of our evacuation areas are tasking my resources right now because we're having to contact those people and put our focuses on them rather than protecting some other structures and getting this repopulation area going again.
Now, the weather has helped a bit. The winds have slowed down a bit today. A little bit more humidity has helped fight this fire. Tomorrow could be another active day of fire, and then Shep, firefighters might get some help on Sunday when we expect snow.
Hope so. Steve, thanks. Snow in Colorado, red flag warnings across the west, as high winds are expected to kick up this weekend in California. Jeff Raineri is the chief meteorologist at NBC News Bay Area. Yeah. Jeff, is that snow going to be enough to help these firefighters?
I really think it's going to put a major dent in that firefighting effort, if not totally get, you know, almost complete containment because of that amount of snow. Let's get to the weather maps right now. This is going to be a major weather whiplash for those folks in Colorado. We have the wind into Saturday, 30 to about 50 mile per hour wind gust. Then as this storm drops down once we hit Sunday, a cold blast of air, also that snow, and then on the backside of it, that same storm is going to bring wind to California. Let's take you down to the snow. We just heard from our reporter there in Grand Lake, you know, how dangerous those conditions are. By Sunday morning, 8:30, we're seeing about 2 inches of snow in Grand Lake, Rustic 6 inches. That's right in the fire zone where over 376,000 acres have burned. Then as you move into Sunday night, also into Monday, look at that snow stack up, 1 to close to 2 feet of snow.
Wow.
Temperatures also daytime highs in the 20s, lows down to minus 10 degrees.
Good grief.
So that's the help those firefighters need. As we get out here to this wider view, you can see on the backside of that storm system, the wind driving down across Northern California. And this is the other problem, that same storm producing this fire danger. So right here in the Bay Area, from Napa and Sonoma down to San Francisco and San Jose, 20 to 50 plus mile per hour winds in the mountains, 15 to 40 mile per hour wind gusts in the lower elevations. And Shep, with this fire danger coming in, PG&E, our power equipment company, is cutting power to thousands of people as we move through Sunday, Monday, and Tuesday, so their equipment doesn't start additional fire. So another thing to deal with here in 2020.
I'll say, hang on, Jeff Raineri, thanks. There's new drug on the street. Have you heard about this? Experts say it's killed something like 30 people in just the past couple of months. This from doctors in Louisiana. They're calling it purple heroin. It contains brorafine, which is a drug scientists really don't know that much about yet. They say it's just as dangerous as fentanyl, and compared to morphine, it's 100 times more potent. Incredible. Health officials in multiple states are on high alert now, hoping to get ahead of the spread. Deaths in Michigan, Arizona, and Minnesota. The first reported death in Louisiana just yesterday. Experts say it's most likely made in China or Mexico, early stages. Watch this one. Vaccine trials back on for two major companies, but testing for kids has literally just begun. The director of the National Institutes of Health is next. And Purell, check. Mask, got it. Candy Cannon, okay. We call them the Halloween hackers. Parents with tricks for safety handing out those treats. But first, voting in space is now a thing with no commuting and no lines. Check this out. NASA astronaut Kate Rubins creating her own voting booth and casting her ballot on board the International Space Station. NASA astronauts able to vote while they float. Thanks to a special law passed back in 1997, it requires astronauts to select elections in which they plan to vote 1 year ahead of their launch. Then an absentee ballot goes to an address marked Low Earth Orbit through the care of NASA. Finally, the astronaut gets the ballot, fills it out, and NASA returns it to the local election board. Space voting, new, and all the astronaut rage. Housing is hot. That's what's topping CNBC's On the Money. Home prices at a record 15% higher than a year ago. The median price more than $320,000 across the nation. That from the real estate brokerage firm Redfin. The CEO telling CNBC that the pandemic-driven boom could last into next year. The fall typically slower time for home sales, but not this time around. Hard seltzer, the drink of choice. Truly sales soaring. So is demand for Twisted Tea. Boston Beer reporting better than expected earnings, raising its profit forecast for the year. The stock hit a new high, but the pandemic is creating some challenges. Sales of Sam Adams and Angry Orchard are not as strong. Closed bars, shuttered restaurants, cutting into demand. iPhone sales for the iPhone 12 worldwide start today in New York, no mad rush. In China, there were lines, though not as long. The pandemic changing things. Apple capping the number of people allowed in stores, more express pickups to limit contact with other shoppers, and no contact deliveries good to go. Demand for the new iPhone expected to be strong. On Wall Street, a mixed finish to end the week. Dow down 28, dragged lower by shares of Intel and American Express. S&P up 11, NASDAQ plus 42. Cool critter time. This is the diabolical ironclad beetle. That's its name, not hyperbole. Look at this. Watch this Toyota Camry try to take it out.
Test one. Diabolical ironclad Beetle. It's playing dead. No fracture, but it's still alive.
Oh, Beetle. In case you're keeping score, that's Beetle 1, midsize sedan 0. Researchers at UC Irvine are studying this amazing insect because it can withstand a force equal to 39,000 times its body weight. And they're looking to use the Beetle's design to build ultra-durable material and everything from bicycles to airplanes. A new set of wheels rolling through the streets and a life-saving rescue caught on video as we take a CNBC trip coast to coast. Texas. A sheriff's deputy jumps into action when a newborn stops breathing. Brazos County, north of Houston. Body cam video shows a deputy turn the baby over onto its stomach. Then he does the Heimlich maneuver.
Come on, baby.
The baby starts breathing again about a minute later. His parents say he's doing just fine. Delaware. High school football season back in Wilmington. And these new helmets are getting a lot of attention. They come with a face mask that attaches on the inside. Players say they can breathe a lot easier, and it keeps them on the field. Virginia. This toaster-looking thing is actually an Arlington suburb's new shuttle. Weird shape and no driver. It's slow, only goes about 10 miles an hour, but riders say it gets them there. Pennsylvania. Gritty smashes one into the night sky. The Philadelphia Flyers mascot with a pretty good golf swing. You see the ball flies off the tee. Gritty celebrates with a club flip and his signature belly dance on a CNBC trip, coast to coast. I'm Shepard Smith on CNBC. It's the bottom of the hour. Time for the top of the news. Coronavirus killing more than 850 people in the U.S. yesterday. One of the three of them from the Midwest. That's from Johns Hopkins. In Wisconsin, 42 new COVID death hospitalizations in the University of Washington Hospital in Madison have almost doubled since the beginning of this month. NBC's Gabe Gutierrez with a rare look inside a COVID unit.
Shep, today Wisconsin reported more than 4,300 new coronavirus cases, and University Hospital here in Madison has now expanded to three COVID units. The one we saw today has a capacity of 28 beds. Not long ago, it reached that point, but today it had 20 patients. This isn't just pockets of COVID anymore. Almost all Wisconsin counties have what public health officials say are very high levels of the virus. Many of the frontline workers here are exhausted.
It's devastating. It's terrifying to see someone struggling to breathe. You can see the fear in their eyes. You can see how scared they are and how they're just how uncertain their future is. And for us, not knowing whether or not someone's going to survive this.
People are sitting in here very sick. They are lonely. They are dealing with this alone. And it's becoming increasingly harder for us to try to manage and playing all these different roles, playing the nurse, playing the support person. It's very difficult, so you really need to protect yourselves and do whatever you can to not get this virus.
And Shep, the Big Ten Conference kicks off its college football season tonight, the Wisconsin Badgers against Illinois, and fans are being urged not to congregate. Police are cracking down on any crowds larger than 25 people. No tailgating is allowed, but healthcare workers we spoke with are begging people not to congregate. They're busy preparing for what could be a harsh winter as flu season takes hold. Shep?
Gabe, thanks. Health regulators giving the green light to resume two major COVID vaccine trials. Investigators found no evidence that the unexplained illnesses were related in any way to AstraZeneca and Johnson & Johnson's vaccine trials. That's according to the companies themselves. The National Institutes of Health helping lead the charge in a search for the vaccine. The NIH director, Dr. Francis Collins, joins us now. Dr. Collins, thank you. Are we getting close, or how would you characterize it?
I would say the pace of vaccine development since January has been unprecedented and rather breathtaking. When you consider normally every other vaccine we've ever tried to prepare has taken 4, 6, 8, 10 years, and here we are in October, expecting that if all goes well, we will have at least one vaccine that is proven safe and effective by the end of 2020. This has never been done before, never even close. And of course, everybody's concerned about, is it being done by cutting corners? I want to reassure everyone that the safety and the efficacy standards for these vaccines have never been higher. You heard about the two trials that were stopped temporarily because somebody in the tens of thousands who were getting the vaccine or maybe a placebo got an illness and you wanted to be sure it wasn't connected. That's an indication of how serious the safety standards are. But it's looking promising. I gotta tell you, there's still all kinds of uncertainties here. And until we have that judgment that we got there, let's be careful and not over assume the conclusion, but it's looking pretty good.
Love to hear that, Dr. Collins. Here's the thing I didn't understand. I always figured if it's good for an adult, it's a vaccine, it's good for kids. But now I know it isn't. And that they've just started testing one, that Pfizer just got a green light to test for kids. Why so late on that?
You know, it's not that late. These vaccine trials, big scale phase three, as they're called, really only got started at the end of July, and we're in October. I think this is the ethical approach. You don't want to, with a vaccine where you're not quite sure whether there might be some safety issues, to start giving that to children until you've tried it out a bit on people who may be better able to handle a side effect. But the time is now coming, and Pfizer has announced they're going to start offering this to children and their parents in trials down to age 12. I think other companies will probably follow suit. It's a balance, Shepard. You do want to be sure that kids have access to the vaccine because they're going to need it too. But you don't want to jump into that too early when they are the most vulnerable little people. And we want to be sure we don't do harm.
Little COVID monsters. They don't show signs, but they spread it to grandma. Doctor, it's great to hear from you tonight. Encouraging. And we thank you.
All right. Glad to be with you.
New COVID restrictions are scaring people away from a Halloween hotspot. Every year, thousands of witches and goblins travel to Salem, Massachusetts, the city famous for the witch trials. But not this year. Officials are discouraging the very tourists who boost the city's economy. COVID ruins everything. All Halloween events are canceled. Businesses forced to close early. Fines for noise violations and public intoxication tripled. Limited train service for the next couple of weekends, too. Salem's mayor says the measures are working. People are staying away. Okay. And it's not just Salem, really. Halloween looking different in lots of spots across the country. New York's classic parade that draws a million people to Greenwich Village every year, canceled. Chicago's, too. Atlanta went virtual. Coordinators saying big crowds during COVID, just too risky. But Halloween is coming, and some families who really like it hacked their way to a happy Halloween. Here's CNBC's Andrea Day.
Check out the candy cannon. Launching sweets 25 feet through the air for socially distanced trick-or-treating.
Even though everything else is weird right now, we can still find a creative solution to give them a fun Halloween.
They're the people across the country.
This is Artie.
On a mission to save Halloween.
I can't imagine as a kid leading up to Halloween, the excitement only to find out it was canceled.
From the candy cannon at the Oplers in Minnesota Lake, Minnesota, to this drone at the Keys House in Austin, Texas, dropping candy down to kids.
There are safe ways of doing things, and I just wanted to go into solution mode.
So how about 30 feet of social distancing? That's the plan in Garden City, Michigan, where the Thompsons will be ziplining candy to kids. And meet Artie the Robot. He'll be cruising the Keys neighborhood in Austin, Texas, delivering treats to kids on his tray.
We sort of call it reverse trick-or-treating.
To prevent crowds, you have to sign up for the no-contact delivery.
It's a scary time for adults. It's a really scary time for kids. What can we do? I think having a robot come and deliver candy is definitely going to be a good memory.
In another part of the city, the Grenier family built this candy slide.
It does create a pretty good distance between the people who are passing out the candy and then the people at the end.
In Port Washington, New York, the Gross family is hanging candy in a tree for a grab-and-go Halloween.
The time, the effort, the energy, every last bit of it is worth it.
A few blocks away, parents created a candy map of the neighborhood.
So that parents of kids know which houses are safe and putting out candy in a safe, socially distanced way.
Like this one at the Boboras house, where hanging from clothespins are bags filled with sweets.
We can't wait. We're going to sit up on the porch, maybe have a glass of wine, and just watch the kids, you know, laugh and have fun.
All right, Shep, and you know those face shields you see medical workers wearing? Well, one company is turning those into Halloween masks for kids. Now, Shep, check this out. Boo! I'm Frankenstein. And this isn't the only one, Shep. We have this one.
Nice.
Friday the 13th.
Uh-huh.
This is big and even a Viking.
Nice. You still have to wear...
And it's all to keep kids...
Go ahead.
You still have to wear a mask under it, but this will, you know, all help kids be a little bit safer this year.
Fun is not crushed. Andrea, you're the best. Thank you. One of the biggest moments of last night's debate, Vice President Biden ready to take on the oil and gas industry. Even the president pointed out, ooh, that's a big statement. Remember? It was. Will America gain or lose jobs if we actually go that green? And meet the man holding a record most people would never want. Arrests. When we go around the world in 80 seconds.
The facts, the truth, the news with Shepard Smith, back in 90 seconds.
The vote and the future of the energy industry in America, and whether that future lies in renewables or traditional fossil fuels or something in the middle, right? The big moment, or one of them, in last night's debate where President Trump and former Vice President Biden staked out very different positions on the future of fossil fuels in America.
I have a transition from the oil industry, yes.
Oh,
I will
that's
transition.
A big statement.
It is a big statement.
That's a
because
big statement.
I would stop.
Why would you do that?
Because the oil industry pollutes significantly.
Oh. And what he's saying is he is going to destroy the oil industry. Okay. Will you remember that, Texas? Will you remember that, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma?
Yeah, it's a good question. Vice President Biden clarifying some of his comments after the debate, as politicians often do, saying he would not ban fossil fuels or move away from them for roughly another 30 years. CNBC's Brian Sullivan covers the energy sector for us. Brian, you've been talking to folks about this for a long, long time. What's the take on Biden's plan, and do they think that this, as Trump called it, is a vibrant industry?
All right. Hey, Shep. Yeah, well, the question on the Biden plan is, what is the Biden plan? I mean, that's the point. Will there be the reduction of subsidies? Will there be a ban on fracking on federal lands? Which, by the way, is a small percentage. It's only about 10% as well. They're more concerned, Shep, about what happens overall with the Senate and the White House. Remember, if there was ever going to be a ban on fracking, that would have to come from Congress. Now, the president called the oil and gas industry vibrant. All right, let's be clear. The last 4 or 5 years has been very difficult for the oil and gas industry. It was built on two things, as you know, sweat and debt. They got plenty of the former, way too much of the latter. 248 oil and gas company bankruptcies in the last 5 years, up 21% from last year. Obviously, some of that is related to COVID and the price of oil driving down global demand, certainly. But I'm going to put it this way, Shep, and how about this? If you added up the combined market value of every publicly traded oil and gas company in America, it's less than Facebook.
Wow. Let's talk Pennsylvania, because, I mean, there's no state bigger in this swing state business and lots of oil and gas and fracking.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people don't realize. First oil well in America was drilled in Pennsylvania, second biggest natural gas producer. Tens of thousands of people work directly, tens of thousands more indirectly. Here's the thing, Shep. The margin of victory for Trump was 1.2% in Pennsylvania in 2016, just over 63,000 votes. That's about 1% of the state's workforce. If you want to win the White House, you have to win Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, a key state. To win Pennsylvania, you're not going to be able to alienate any industry, given that the margin of victory could certainly be that close again.
Really could. Brian Sullivan, good to see you again. Thank you. A Chilean man breaking a terrible record and a prison fire in Nigeria as we go round the world in 80 seconds.
Nigeria, a prison set on fire. Gunshots ring out as smoke rises above the facility. No word yet on whether this is a prison break or an outside attack. All this is protests to end police brutality grow in the country. Amnesty International reports soldiers killed at least 38 people this week. Hashtag end SARS. Chile. This man breaking a unique record. Police arresting him 116 times. And he's only 23 years old. On his rap sheet, robbery, assault, and burglary. Video shows him crawling inside a restaurant after it closed. Cops appear moments later with their guns drawn and cuff him. A judge ordering him to only overnight house arrest. United Kingdom. A picture of Prince William sending royal fans into a frenzy. That's his royal thinness peering into a KFC. The fast food chain tweeting, "Oh, I just can't wait to be wing," a play on the famous Lion King song. The photo racking up in a few hours, more than 30,000 likes. United Arab Emirates. The city with the world's tallest building now has the largest water fountain. Dubai celebrating the record by lighting up the sky with fireworks. The fountain has 3,000 LED lights, and it's the size of two baseball fields. Now that's making a splash as we go around the world in 80 seconds. Ah, remote learning. No playgrounds, no cafeterias, but the bullies are still there. All they need is a keyboard. Teachers may not see it happen, but you can. And Loving County, Texas, population about four dozen, plus one extra tonight, NBC's Jay Gray. Hey, Loving has quite the COVID claim to fame.
Yeah, Shep, you're absolutely right. No lockdown here, no mask mandate, and no COVID-19. We'll take a closer look.
COVID Watch. We spend an awful lot of time talking about where COVID is surging for obvious reasons. But tonight we also want to show you where it's not. There are exactly 3,141 counties in America, but only three are COVID-free. Kalawao County in Hawaii, Esmeralda County in Nevada, and Loving County, Texas. NBC's Jay Gray is there tonight. Jay, no COVID. Dream come true.
You're absolutely right. Look, being here is like being back at the time before the pandemic. This little pocket of West Texas, the driver here, oil and gas and ranching. But they've also got a built-in advantage when it comes to the virus. Wide open and extreme social distancing.
There are more cattle than people in Loving County, Texas.
We're very close to the federal description of frontier, less than six people per square mile.
There's no shopping center, no Starbucks, not even a traffic light. Another thing you won't find here, COVID-19.
So far, we haven't had any cases here.
Zero. Not a single positive test recorded. Joining Esmeralda County in Nevada and an area the locals call Kulaupapa in Hawaii as the only places in the U.S. untouched by the virus. There's been no lockdown in Loving County. The only church and school were closed long before the pandemic. There's been no mandate to wear masks.
I don't wear a mask anywhere. You know, I mean, I'm a germaphobe also, so I keep my hands washed. I keep my distance from people.
So how have they stayed COVID-free?
See you later, Chuck.
Chuck Floosh, serving breakfast and lunch at Chuck's Wagon, says the answer's pretty simple.
Who's here to give it to us?
Less than 170 people live in the county. Neighbors separated by fence posts and miles of scrub brush and cactus. Social distancing is just a way of life here.
It is different, and I think it speaks well for the rural areas. For the most part, people respect each other. They normally keep their distance.
Things do move at a different pace, a little slower, but still fast enough to avoid COVID-19.
Yeah, and you know, another striking thing about being here, unless we bring it up, you don't hear a word about COVID-19. In fact, nobody talks about it. There are no banners here. There's no warnings about trying to stay safe. It's really amazing, Shep, to see what's going on here.
Be careful. People will be invading them. Nobody needs that. Jay, thanks. COVID concern is why millions of students are out of school and learning online. The big picture, students and teachers have found new ways to have class, but they still have old classroom problems. For one, the school bully is not kept at bay on Zoom. Some bullies are still at it, and now everybody can see it. Even record it. Tim Furlong of our NBC station WCAU in Philly
on how it's happening.
Mom, I think you should see this.
It happened to Linda's kid in the first week of school. She got bullied in the virtual classroom.
It was filled with homophobia. One kid actually, you know, typed in there, KYS, kill yourself.
Child psychologists at Nemours Adupont Hospital for Children say they're seeing this more and more. Kids using the text chat feature on Zoom or Google Meet platforms to make fun of other kids. Some really nasty stuff.
We're also noticing that kids are getting teased sometimes for either what they have in their background or maybe what they don't have if it's a household where there's not a lot of resources there.
It's just usually cute and innocent, just a hello.
Carla is an elementary school teacher. She says her students are generally pretty innocent on the chats. She warns them to keep it positive.
And I just remind them that I can see every single message that's there. And that, you know, the principal checks too.
But all it takes is one child to make a mean comment about someone else, and then you have several people jumping in on that.
Yeah, that's what happened to Crystal. The principal learned five kids in her class were making the really harsh comments.
And the only reason they're doing it is because they feel like they have that disconnect there where they can do it.
Kids should know their names are attached to the comments they make, but teachers have so much on their plates, it's easy for them to miss the comments that are flying in and out quickly. Dr. Wallheater says you should check in from time to time on your virtual learners. Look for behavioral changes or notice if they're hesitant to log on for classes. Help them learn to make appropriate small talk in the virtual classes. And if they or you see bullying, reach out to teachers and school administrators.
And remind kids, anything they say while they're tucked here cozy in their little Zoom box, eventually they're going to be back in the real world in a real classroom. They're going to be face-to-face with the people they hurt. So the best advice across the board just always seems to be nice to everybody. Shep?
Love it. Thanks so much. Some final thoughts and some pretty pictures before we head out for the weekend. Hope you'll stay with us. Just a couple more. Ah, pumpkins and the good stuff of October. It is the Northeast magic season. Before that one morning, days or weeks from now, when all the leaves have left the trees and Old Man Winter arrives, fall fun is over. Beautiful, right? Love this time of year. Not to be a downer on a Friday night, but before we go, I need to tell you, those of us in New York and the Northeast, we're worried about you. Our friends and our loved ones and our viewers across the country, now more than ever, really. This new COVID surge is awful. So follow the Fauci. Not for us. We're mostly good around here. We're worried for you. So please follow the Fauci. In the spring and early summer, we lived the horror of neighbors and friends sick and dying. Doctors and nurses we know and admire so were in the depths of depression, inside hospitals with no more beds, with the freezer trucks outside full of victims whose families never got to say goodbye. We could bang our pots and pans from our windows to show love for our heroes, but we couldn't help, except we went into lockdown. Our region was like a sprawling ghost town, everybody indoors, thawing chicken for dinner again and playing cards and watching Netflix for hours and weeks on end, every day, Groundhog Day, missing our friends and our lives so much to slow the spread and end the death and suffering. And finally, it worked. We're scarred, but better now, and at least for now, because we followed the rules and beat COVID back. We had to. Many of you are not doing that. And the doctors tell us you will now suffer mightily, like we did, or worse, because lockdown is largely not coming to you. Scientists tell us the months ahead will be historically bad, unless you make a personal decision to follow the Fauci. We here want a world where you avoid what we endured. It was horrible, debilitating, and life-altering, if not life-ending. Follow the Fauci. Wear a mask. Socially distance. Save parties and weddings for another time. Holidays apart will be hard. So that COVID doesn't become for you what it is forevermore for us. Start this weekend. Follow the Fauci, and we'll get through this. I'm Shepard Smith at CNBC Global Headquarters. We'll see you back here on Monday. You've been listening to the CNBC podcast, The News with Shepard Smith. You can always catch us live weekdays at 7 p.m. Eastern, only on CNBC.